So at the end of the war, he looked for a place to continue rehabilitation work. And the only place available was a garage. And people came to him for help, garage or no garage. There were too many, with bodies often too damaged to be given aid in this place. Everything was crude except the good intentions.
Well, that's old Blue Eyes himself, American singer and actor Frank Sinatra, narrating a tale of high hopes for rehabilitation patients in Indonesia. I'm Matt Wells, and for this edition of our podcast classic series, we'll hear the famous entertainer speak of the debilitating lifelong effects of polio, a disease the World Health Organization, WHO, now has on the ropes with its polio eradication and endgame strategic plan. Polio is one of several vaccine-preventable diseases that WHO hopes to highlight during its World Immunization Week. You'll hear more on that and more from Sinatra later in the podcast. But first, we'll join Sinatra's A Hole in the Head co-star, Romanian-born actor Edward G. Robinson, on a unique hunt.
Her victims were mounting, a reign of terror laying a deadly net over this village in northern Lebanon. She had been seen in several places, but the local police were at a loss to cope with her. My job? Find the murderers.
That was Robinson in 1956, describing the devastation wrought by the malaria-spreading mosquito. In observance of World Malaria Day, we'll revisit this film noir-style dramatization of the fight against the mosquito-borne disease. Afterwards, we'll hear from a malaria expert on the latest developments. Now, here's Edward G. Robinson in The Murderess.
This is Edward G. Robinson. Today, I'm playing a familiar role, but with a not-so-familiar twist. My quarry is a murderer's. I can hear a voice. Her song is sweetly persuasive, soft to the ear. She steals quietly about in the silence of the night, or comes in unexpectedly in the heat of the high noon. She gives no warning of her approach. She tends to seek out warm, inviting places where the food is good and the lodging is comfortable. But do not be fooled by her lilting song, for those can die. That is why I was called in on the case. Her victims were mounting, a reign of terror laying a deadly net over this village in northern Lebanon. She had been seen in several places, but the local police were at a loss to cope with her. My job? Find the murderers. It was about 10 in the morning when my assistants and I climbed out of our jeep into the sun-baked main street of this small village. We'd brought our equipment with us. If and when we found this she-demon, she wouldn't live long. We would see to that. The chief contacted us presently and told us we might use his house as headquarters. It's a mud house like the others, whitewashed inside. We asked the chief to round up as many villagers as possible for questioning, and soon they make their appearance. An old man approached me cautiously, reaches out a thin hand as if to touch me. He has never seen me before, but he will see me again, often. A woman tries to quiet her crying child. He looks ill, but his lusty lungs fill the room. Now the room is ringed with men and women seated on mattresses on the floor. It's time to begin the questioning. I ask for a description of the wanted female. There are many answers. She's been seen at the village well, in the huts of the people. She seems to be everywhere at once. They all know her, hate her for what she has done to them. Their eyes look up at me dark with fear. I try to calm them with the knowledge that soon she will be apprehended. But their eyes doubt my words. And then, her voice is heard in the room. The murderess has returned to the scene of her crime. And it's time for us to go to work. In northern Lebanon, and in many other countries, the word mosquito, the female Anopheles mosquito, to be precise, is synonymous with murder. For her bite can inflict dreaded malaria, the disease that wastes away the population of tropical countries. That is why the WHO, the World Health Organization, has sent me here with a team of trained experts. We're going to spray this village with DDT, test the adults and children for malaria, and when cases are found, administer anti-malaria tablets. Our object is to rid the village of malaria and its carrier, the murderous mosquito. It's not an easy job. First, we must fight local prejudice against the unknown, the different. We must instill confidence in these peoples that we wish to help them. And we must keep that confidence, for we will be returning again every so often to check on the progress that has been made. We hope it will be a clean sweep. After reports have been written, tests made, the village sprayed, we move on to the next village and the one after that. Day after day, our little caravan travels slowly after the murderers. I'm happy to say it's becoming more difficult to find her. The lady is slowly vanishing from Lebanon, Greece, the Philippines, India. But it's a time-consuming effort, and this lady, once scorned, is twice as dangerous. We must always be on the alert. You see? Her kind can't easily be eradicated from the earth. She's too persistent, strong-willed. But we will do our best, and in doing so, save millions from the dread of her bite. Just as we tried to stamp out tuberculosis in Costa Rica, malnutrition in Pakistan, hunger and want the world over, we shall keep on pursuing this murderess until her voice is no longer heard on this earth.
The Murderess, narrated by Edward G. Robinson in 1956. WHO has had its attention on malaria since the organisation's founding in 1948. This year's World Malaria Day theme is Ready to Beat Malaria. Dr. David Schellenberg, scientific advisor to the WHO Global Malaria Programme, spoke to Omar Muzni about how far we've come in the battle against malaria over the past 70 years.
7 decades ago, we knew what caused malaria, we knew how malaria was transmitted, but we didn't really have any tools to control malaria. We were dependent on trying to modify the environment. The malaria control landscape has been completely transformed by the development of insecticides to kill mosquitoes, the development of drugs to treat malaria episodes in people, and also greatly enhanced by the development of diagnostic tests, rapid diagnostic tests, and also more recently still, innovations in information technology, which mean that we can do a much better job of surveillance.
At the same time, it seems as though some of the data from the recent years suggests that there has been a stall in the fight against malaria. What would you say is the most alarming thing about where we are now as opposed to where we were a few years ago?
Okay, well, I think first of all we should recognise the terrific progress that has been made since the beginning of this millennium. You know, in the year 2000, the estimates were that there were 1 million people dying every year from malaria, about 90% of those being young children in sub-Saharan Africa. There were only a couple of malaria drugs available, but there was a high level of resistance to both chloroquine and to sulfadoxine pyrimethamine, the other widely used drug. There was just one class of insecticide that was recommended for the prevention of malaria through the use of insecticide-treated mosquito nets. And although it was known that mosquito nets improved survival, there was no finance mechanism to facilitate the purchase and supply of these nets. The total global investment in the year 2000 in malaria was around about $100 million, which, to put it in perspective, was about the budget of some of the blockbuster films that were being made at the same time. If you fast forward 15 years, over 1 billion insecticide-treated mosquito nets have been distributed. So getting on for 70% of target group in sub-Saharan Africa are now using insecticide-treated mosquito nets. In the same time period, in the last 15 years or so, 6 countries have managed to eliminate malaria. We estimate that something like 1.2 billion malaria episodes have been averted and 6.2 million malaria deaths have been averted. So really astonishing progress. But as you said, in the last year or two, progress has stalled. In 2016, the latest estimates from WHO show that there are about 445,000 people still dying of malaria every year, and 90% of these being young children in sub-Saharan Africa. And probably the root question is, or the root cause of that, is a failure to be able to generate the level of resources that are required. About $2.7 billion has been invested in malaria in the year 2016, and that's about 41% of the $6.5 billion that is estimated that would be needed to really make the most of the control tools that are available.
So you mentioned sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, and is it 80% of malaria cases are found in 15 countries and most of those are in sub-Saharan Africa?
That's right, yes. About 80%, as you say, in 15 countries, 70% in 11 countries. Actually, 25% in just one country, and that's Nigeria.
What factors do you think make those countries particularly vulnerable to malaria outbreaks?
So malaria is a complicated disease because it's transmitted by a vector. That vector is the female Anopheles mosquito. And there are lots of different subspecies, each subspecies having different preferences in terms of what sorts of creature it likes to take its blood meals from, where it likes to rest, where it likes to feed, what time it likes to feed. And so the specific details of the vector which is involved in malaria transmission in different places, I think, is a major factor in determining the level of malaria transmission. But there are also issues around the access to quality services to enable the diagnosis and adequate treatment of malaria, which, as we will readily appreciate, greatly vary from one place to another.
Speaking of the mosquito, you earlier mentioned insecticides, and we know that early in the fight against malaria, there was a lot of success using DDT to eradicate mosquitoes, and then they discovered that there were mosquitoes that were resistant to certain insecticides, and also that DDT itself had some side effects. Can you talk a little bit about the current tools that we have to eradicate the mosquitoes, insecticides that we use now, how they affect people, the environment, and whether or not mosquitoes are resistant to them?
I think, first of all, we should make a distinction between eradication of mosquitoes and eradication of malaria. Malaria is caused by a parasite which is carried by mosquitoes. They get infected with the parasite when they feed on somebody who's already got malaria, and then they're very effective at passing it on to other people. So we don't necessarily set out to completely eliminate mosquitoes, but what we want to do is prevent them from transmitting malaria. So DDT has been a very effective part of the approach to controlling the mosquito vectors. As you rightly say, though, there are environmental concerns, and it has been banned from use in agriculture. But it can still play a useful role. Having said that, we're no longer completely dependent on DDT because there are now four different classes of insecticide which are available to control mosquitoes. But we should not be complacent. There's a real need to try to stay one step ahead in the arms race against the malaria-carrying mosquitoes and the malaria parasite itself.
Maybe we can turn our attention now to the patients and those infected with malaria. What can you tell us about the quality of treatment for malaria patients?
In the early 2000s, we were entirely dependent on single agents, single drugs to treat malaria, for example, chloroquine or sulfadoxine pyrimethamine. But resistance has developed pretty rapidly to these drugs. And there was a strong argument that we should be combining drugs which act in different ways on the parasite, so that it makes it more difficult for the parasite to become resistant to those. So we are now in a relatively strong position. There are five so-called ACTs, that's artemisinin-based combination treatments, which are recommended by WHO for the treatment of malaria.
And what about immunization and preventive treatment? Malaria Day falls right in the middle of World Immunization Week, and I understand that there is a plan to roll out a vaccine that can partially help to prevent infection.
Yes, indeed. We are now, after over 30 years of concerted efforts to develop this first-generation malaria vaccine, it's called RTSS. We're now in the stages of planning the pilot implementation with a rigorous evaluation in three countries in Africa. So the pilot program will start in Ghana and Kenya and Malawi, just some of the most highly malarious parts of those countries. And we'll run for about 3 years to generate the evidence needed to inform a policy decision about the wider utility of the vaccine.
Could you stress the importance of people participating in the vaccination program against malaria?
One of the major challenges challenges in delivering malaria control is that it depends on people being able to access health facilities when they're sick. The other challenge is getting mosquito nets and vector control products to people in the communities. So we're very eager to evaluate the extent to which a malaria vaccine delivered through routine immunisation services can help to build the coverage of effective malaria control tools in a community. Vaccination programmes have been running since the 1970s, have been building in strength and offer an unparalleled platform to deliver preventive health interventions.
The World Health Organization's Dr. David Schellenberg there, speaking of the fight against malaria and the promising future of an anti-malarial vaccine, which, if proven effective, can become another tool against communicable diseases. Which brings us right back to World Immunization Week and polio. This year's theme for the week, Protected Together, Vaccines Work, encourages people at all levels to go further in their efforts to increase immunisation coverage. Polio cases have decreased by an astonishing 99% since the creation in 1988 of the Global Polio Eradication Initiative, or GPEI, a comprehensive monitoring and vaccination programme to deliver a polio-free world. Listen now as Frank Sinatra describes the struggles that faced young polio victims when the disease was still rampant.
This is Frank Sinatra. Suppose you were told that a major operation, though not essential, would change your entire life, open new and wider chances for happiness. Would you consent? Well, this was the decision that faced a young man named Ansar. Ansar lived in Indonesia. He lived, though never in his 19 years had he walked or taken a single step. He was a polio victim at the age of 3 months. And when he learned to creep, he had to continue creeping because his legs were too weak for walking. At the age of 19, he was admitted to the rehabilitation center at Solo, where surgery and vocational training are given. They examined him and decided surgery could help. But Ansar refused, absolutely. He said he'd only come there to learn a trade. All he wanted was to be a shoemaker or a tailor or something like that, so he could work sitting still the rest of his life. He refused the operation. So, one might ask, what was the good of this remarkable rehabilitation center in the case of Ansar? It was here that Dr. Sohaso, an Indonesian surgeon, began operating on and repairing as best he could the victims of the 6 years of bitter fighting in that area. And all the time, he thought of the problems that would face these incapacitated men and women. So, at the end of the war, he looked for a place to continue rehabilitation work. And the only place available was a garage. And people came to him for help, garage or no garage. There were too many, with bodies often too damaged to be given aid in this place. Everything was crude except the good intentions. So, Dr. Sohaso looked around for help. But how could he expect anyone to notice his problems in a remote corner of Indonesia? Nevertheless, it did happen. He went on with his work, and in time, word of what was being done at Solo reached the United Nations. The UN sent the well-known American rehabilitation expert, Dr. Henry Kessler, to Solo to observe and report. And it was Dr. Kessler's conviction that the work being done at Solo was unique in that part of the world and could be a model for the whole area. After that, the story becomes one of a remarkable bit of cooperation among government, the United Nations, and many agencies and organizations. Now, there is an orthopedic hospital teaching program, a surgery and all the modern requirements, laundry, kitchen, hot water, sanitation facilities. Also, a brace shop for making braces and artificial limbs, and a vocational shop. But our young friend Ansar gave no thought to an operation for himself. The fact of the matter was that Ansar was much too frightened. But in the ward, he soon made friends. One young fellow in particular interested him, a boy named Mardi. Ansar felt so sorry for poor Mardi because Mardi's hands had been injured and were useless to him. And Ansar brooded about this so much, he discussed it with the nurses and learned that Mardi could be helped if he would submit to a series of operations. After all, even though Ansar himself had troubles, he did have the use of his hands. Well, it seemed to Ansar a terrible pity that Mardi didn't let them operate. Finally, he had to speak to Mardi, tell him he must let the doctors help. Well, maybe it seems ironic, but Anso was quite shocked when he learned Mardi felt the same way toward him. Pitied him. He, Anso, felt he should let the doctors operate. And so they argued about their cases, kept trying to argue each other to the operating table, until it became a case of, I will if you will. Well, at that point, Anso couldn't let his friend Mardi go first. He had too much pride for that. So, although Anso was terrified, he rode into the operating room. And later, when he was on his crutches learning to walk, he had the privilege of giving courage to his friend Mardi. Now here they are, both recovering and telling each other all about their operations. And that is how two lives were transformed in a garage in Solo, a tiny spot on the map of Indonesia.
The legendary Frank Sinatra, lending his star power to the World Health Organization when it was a little over a decade old. That brings us to the end of this edition of UN News Podcast Classics. You can find the two programmes heard here, as well as a wealth of many other archived audio, video and photos, at the UN Audiovisual Library, which is at www.unmultimedia.org/AV Library. I'm Matt Wells. Thank you for listening.